From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. How well you smell says a lot about how healthy you are, not how good you smell, although scientists are working at diagnosing some illnesses by odors you give off. But how efficient you are in perceiving smells is a measure of health. If an older woman loses ability to pick up smells, her social circle shrinks. Curiously, that's not true of men. Smell sneaks into the subconscious brain, even a patient in a coma. Cognitive psychologist Johan Lundstrom of the Monell Chemical Sense Center in Philadelphia tells us that's different from how senses like sight and hearing reach us.
Odors are very good in changing the interpretation of the signals we get from the other senses. So odors is as a context, so it allows us to better interpret what we are getting from the other senses.
It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Why do some smells repel us more than others, and why do some immediately trigger a memory? What are the effects if someone loses their ability to smell? Of all the senses, the way our sense of smell functions remains the most mysterious to the science community, but that's changing. Today we're joined by Johan Lundstrom, a cognitive psychologist working to untangle and understand the path that smell follows inside the brain and the way the sense of smell, also called olfaction, affects our lives. Lundstrom splits his time between his roles as a faculty member at the Monell Chemical Sense Center in Philadelphia and as an associate professor in the Department of Clinical Neuroscience at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden. Lundstrom says his core interest is where biology interacts with psychology. By imaging brain activity and watching how neurons respond when activated by odors, he can look at what happens when our senses interact. If that sounds complex, you're right, and now he'll help us understand. Welcome to On the Record.
Hello. I'm very happy to be here.
So first, the study of olfaction is relatively new compared to what scientists know about sight or hearing or other senses. Why is that?
Well, first of all, I mean, study of olfaction has been going for many, many years, starting with the old Greek. But the really kickoff, like when more people doing it and a bigger interest, started just a few years ago, I would say. And I would say the big shift was when the Nobel Prize in Medicine was awarded to two scientists who discovered olfactory receptor structure.
So that got people interested. What were there factors holding research back before that?
So two factors. One is that for many, many years, and many still think so, that there's an opinion out there that the human sense of smell doesn't really work.
Doesn't work? And
yeah, so that's an opinion that you can see in even today in textbooks, that they state that when we got color vision, we lost the sense of smell. And then we have that, it's almost a residual sense, you know, a sense that doesn't really work. But the fact of the matter is that if you actually test humans, you test animals and how good can they smell odors, you will find, and studies have shown now, that humans are actually better than most animals. There are very few animals that actually beat us when it comes to smelling odors.
Dogs presumably beat us.
Dogs are very good, but we are actually better than a very famous smeller such as the rat. So we beat the rat when it comes to most odors. But humans are very good in discriminating odors, but humans are extremely poor when it comes to identifying odors. We are very good when it comes to classifying odors. In other words, if a given odor, you will be very good in saying, is this edible, non-edible? You also be very good in saying, well, this is actually a flower odor. But you will absolutely suck at saying this is a rose or this is a jasmine or something like that.
Huh.
Yes. So just an example, what do I mean with we are very bad at it, right? So if we give odors to people, tons of odors, and have them identifying, we will find that the very best performance will be for very common odors such as, let's say, coffee or chocolate. But a good performance, that means that 50% of the people can actually say when smelling it, this is coffee. And imagine that if you compare that sample to hearing or seeing something, if I would hold up a pencil, and you will not be able to tell me this is a pencil. I will strongly urge you to go see a doctor because something is not really right with you, right? But if you give you the odor of orange and you will tell me I have no clue, but I think it's some citrus, I will be, okay, it's pretty good. And that is the big difference between olfaction, that sense of smell, and the other senses, that sense of smell is more painting with a broad brush, I like to say. So we're very good in using it to classify things, to help us initiate some important behaviors. Should we approach or avoid?
Give us a sense of what goes on at your labs at the Manel Center and the Karolinska Institute.
So we do a long range of studies, and some people say that what we do sounds a little bit schizophrenic, but it all centers on around how the sense of smell affects our behavior and how the brain interprets this signal and how the sense of smell affects how we interpret other senses.
What else goes on at your labs?
So we also have a range of studies where we're exploring what kind of information are we able to extract from our body odors. And there we're focusing on mostly on two aspects. One is the odor of sickness. So we're trying to determine, can we smell sickness on other individuals? And we have, in a range of studies now, shown that we are very good at that. So we can smell on someone's body odor whether or not they are sick.
Really?
And we can also see that we have identified a brain mechanism that take the odor information and merge that with the visual information we're getting from the sickness cues in the face. And that together makes us extremely good in telling sick apart from healthy. Odors are very good in changing the interpretation of the signals we get from the other senses. So odors is almost, it's as a context. So it allows us to better interpret what we are getting from the other senses.
That's cognitive psychologist Ewan Lundstrom here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Lundstrom's research at the Manel Chemical Sense Center in Philadelphia and the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden, tries to understand how our sense of smell affects the ways we interact in the world. A recent research claim from your lab is that a diminishing sense of smell affects the size of one's social circle, but that's true only for women. Would you unpack this finding for us?
Yeah, so we looked into a big data set that we have access to where we have tested more than 3,000 elderly individuals living in Chicago. And then we tested them in many different aspects. One of those are we assessed their sense of smell, how good they can identify odors. We also have measures of their social life, the amount of social interaction, how many close friends they have, and how often they see family. And what we found there is that it's a link between how good olfactory abilities you have, so how good you can actually identify odors, and the size of your olfactory network, or how rich your social life is. I should be clear that we don't know really the direction here. We don't know if the social life affects your sense of smell or if your sense of smell affects your social life. But My bet would be that it's the sensory functions, olfaction, that is affecting the social life.
This is fascinating. I'm used to understanding that diminishing hearing, for example, in older people isolates them, tends to limit their interactions, and certainly failing eyesight can do that too. I have no idea how having less acute smell could result in fewer social interactions.
Yes, I think that the mechanism is very easy, actually. So if you're thinking about the last 10 times when you have met friends, what have you been doing then? Well, most probably you've either been eating or drinking something. It's a part of our culture that when we meet people, we either give them something to drink or something to eat, or when we go out, we meet in a restaurant or in a bar. You know, so the problem with this for people with reduced sense of smell, which we call anosmia, that you cannot smell, or hyposmia, that you have a poor olfactory function, is that around 90% of all the taste information is actually smell. And if you ask a young child to take a medication that doesn't taste well, what they tend to do is they pinch their nose. And if you pinch your nose, you lose all information other than the basic taste information, sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and then this new, we talk about umami, this kind of meaty taste, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, that if you don't have some smell, The only thing you get then is the spices, if you have a salt in there or if you have some sweet in there. So what a common complaint among people with bad sense of smell is that everything they eat tastes like porridge. And if everything you eat tastes like porridge, it's not really fun to go out and eat with your friends. Because what we do tend to do when we sit and eat, we talk about the food. And you cannot participate. So you tend to be more isolated when it comes to actually going out with your friends, and then you lose contact. Another factor is also that, as we just talked about, we're getting a lot of social information via body odors. And this is yet to be explored, but it could be that individuals with poor olfactory functions, they're losing out on a lot of those social information, which make it more difficult to socially interact with individuals.
But none of that would explain why the finding is this affects women and not men.
Yes. So something we didn't write in the paper, which we wanted to put in, but we were asked to take it out because it's a pure speculation from my side. But I strongly believe that that is actually an artifact of our culture. So we tested now, if you remember, only elderly individuals, so 65 and upwards, up to 90 plus, right? And I think that this is a culture phenomenon that guys of that age are less likely to go out and eat together. If anything, they have maybe a beer together. So, and they talk less about food than elderly women. So I think that this could be a factor, and I predict that if we redo this study in younger individuals, I would predict that we will no longer find this difference between men and women.
Did the sample include different races, different cultures, different classes?
Yeah, so this is what is called a national probability sample, meaning that when they designed the study, they tried to make sure that all aspects of the social community in Chicago are covered. Cover all the races, cover different aspects of social life. So if you're living in a nursing home, if you're living at home, in an apartment or a house, and they try to match the percentage of the Chicago population towards the national population. And what we also do is that we are putting weight on the individual group. So if we are undersampling in one group, let's say elderly black men who lives in a nursing home, well, the few people we have in that group, their answer will then be weighted more. So they account for more of our data, which means that we can with a good certainty say that the result we got is very predictable for the general U.S. population.
You've also conducted research that focuses on something called chemo signaling. What is that?
So chemo signaling is what I talked about before, this information via our body odors. And body odors, I'm not only talking about sweat, but also talking about other type of body odors, such as urine or tears. But we are focusing mostly on sweat. And also, I should say, when you talk about sweat, we are not talking about this 5 days old foul stench. We're talking about what really is coming out of your body a few hours after you showered.
Well, that's one thing that's been in the back of my mind as I've read about your work is how much is it affected by the fact that certainly in America, you have a broader worldview perhaps, we spend so much effort not smelling. I mean, we do deodorants and fragrances and multiple showers and powders. I mean, how does that complicate both how we experience smell and how you study it?
Actually, very little. The only thing we have to tell our participants that do not use any strong odor products on you when we are sampling. But in real life, it doesn't matter that much because the sense of smell is organized in such a way that if you add more odors, we are still getting the information from the odors that are out there. Because each odor molecule is binding to a certain type of receptor. So what you do if you add a strong perfume is that you just activate more receptors. But the receptor activity we are interested in will still be activated. So what is happening when we are using a lot of flagrants on our body to prevent body odors from actually reaching our friends and peers is that we are masking it. We're not removing it, we're just masking it. And that masking is happening in the brain. And it's more a cognitive masking rather than a perceptual masking.
Quick break now in our conversation on the record with cognitive psychologist Ewan Lundstrom. researcher at the Manel Chemical Sense Center and the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden. When we're back, I'll ask how smell influences other senses and how smell loss can be a marker of disease. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Ewan Lindstrom, researcher at Manel Chemical Sense Center and at Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden, is with us. He's also an adjunct professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about his research on olfaction, a sense of smell. It's a common belief that our sense of smell deteriorates as we age. Are you finding this to be true?
So if you look at the population level, it is true. And there's several studies showing that around the age 40 plus, if you look at the whole population, then you see that people's sense of smell start to go down. And if you look at around the age of 80, then it's not much left in the sense of smell. But, and this is a big but, there are several studies showing up now showing that if you test people that have what's called healthy aging, in other words, they could be 80 plus, but they don't have any disease or sickness, they tend to have actually a pretty fully functional sense of smell, almost as good as a young individual. So the drop in olfaction, if you're healthy, seems to be actually less severe than we see, for example, eyesight and hearing.
And what kind of unhealthy aging tends to sap our sense of smell the most?
Yeah, so the biggest impact on an individual is that if you have any some signs of Parkinson or Alzheimer's or MS, or if you have other type of those kind of like neurological diseases, they tend to all heavily influence the sense of smell. But also such benign, such as general, if you have general inflammation, if you hit your head, there's a very strong influence of smell, or if you have the common cold. So common cold virus is one of the biggest killers of the sense of smell, actually. It's a very common cause to why people lose the sense of smell forever.
So that's not just because, or is it, because of buildup of mucus in our sinuses? There's something beyond that the virus does to our sense of smell?
Yes. So when you have the acute phase, then it's just like you block the nose, right, with mucus. But what we see is that even though when you're then done with the cold and you feel perfectly healthy, then there's a small percentage that are coming out of the cold being completely unable to smell. And we don't know exactly why this is happening. We think that there's some individuals that are extra sensitive to the common cold virus, that are then influencing either the receptors or the olfactory nerve going into the brain.
Is olfactory function an indicator of health and disease?
What we are finding in those big population studies that if you have a good sense of smell or bad sense of smell, it's a good indicator of your general health. And there's several studies now showing that if you have a bad sense of smell, you are much more likely to die early than people with good sense of smell. However, one should also be aware that those studies are a little bit confounded by the fact that you then have individuals that have yet to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's and Parkinson, and particularly Parkinson, because we know that 5 to 8 years before you get your clinical diagnosis of Parkinson, you have a very severe drop in your olfactory functions, because one of the first portion of the brain that is affected by Parkinson is the olfactory bulb, which is the first station in the brain, in olfactory brain.
The olfactory bulb.
The olfactory bulb are two Q-tip-like structures, one on each side of each hemisphere, that resides roughly above your eyes. And the factory system works like this, that you have the olfactory receptors in the very top of your nasal cavity. And then from there you have bundles of nerves going through what's called the cribriform plate, which is almost like a strainer looking portion of the skull bone, where those nerves go through and then into those two Q-tips, olfactory bulbs.
Does the sense of smell function differently in our brain than the other senses do?
It functions completely different. So the other senses are organized in such a way that it goes from the receptor organs, so you have the eyes, the ears, the fingertips, or wherever you have your touch sensation, or the tongue for taste, right? And it goes from there into the brainstem and then to the thalamus. And the thalamus is the big switchboard in the brain. We also have a saying in neuroscience that unless something has crossed the thalamus, you're not going to have a conscious experience of what was happening, right? The sense of smell is organized completely different. So you go from the receptor up to the olfactory bulb. From the olfactory bulb, you have then a split in the processing stream. It goes to the main olfactory cortex, the piriform cortex. You have a big pathway that goes into the amygdala. And the amygdala is a part of the brain that codes for information such as saliency, and some people also claim there's as a big center for emotions and a fear. And then you have a big pathway that goes into the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is the part of the brain that store codes for memories. And then you also have a bundle that goes to the hypothalamus, which are coding for big body regulations such as homeostasis. And first thereafter, do you have a certain portion that goes to the thalamus? Meaning that before the olfactory information can even reach consciousness, we have this big processing going on in olfactory cortex, in emotion and saliency areas, in memory, and in body regulation. So the olfactory sense have this unique access to this core and very important basic brain structures that the other senses do not have.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Kass speaking with Johan Lindstrom, a researcher at Monell Chemical Sense Center in Philadelphia and the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden, talking about his findings in studying effects of the sense of smell. You've done some research that deals with identifying sickness through sense of smell. Tell us about that.
Yes, so first of all, we have done many behavioral studies and imaging studies where we just show that people are actually quite good in identifying that people are sick. What we do then, we are injecting healthy individuals with an endotoxin that makes them sick. We actually initiate sickness in individuals. We know that we are doing the manipulation. But I've also been involved with other collaborators that are more interested in the chemistry of sickness, to use this body odor signal to identify actual different type of diseases. And this is a very common knowledge, an age-old from the old Greek, talked about the different kind of diseases smells differently. And if you go down to the basement in the hospitals, to the labs there, and talk to these old guys who've worked there for many years, they will tell you that they can take a blood sample, smell it, and tell you this is a staph infection. Because each of these bacteria have a unique odor profile that they are emitting. So what we're trying to do now is trying to isolate what are the chemicals in that odor, so we can build those electronic noses to identify the different bacteria, but also other type of problems such as skin cancer, breast cancer, and urine bladder cancer.
So that would be a way of diagnosis. Is there any thought of the reverse feedback? In other words, using smell as therapy, using smell to treat illnesses?
Odors can be used to make us calm and more relaxed. But we also have been interested in during the last year here now, is that we have a study from a few years ago where we show that people that are in coma have normal olfactory functions in the brain. So if we compare what's happening in the olfactory portion of the brain in people in coma and normal healthy individuals, we see no difference. And that's, as I said before, that olfaction is the sense that bypass the thalamus. And people in coma often have problem with their thalamus function. And with sense of smell, we don't have to bother with that because it goes right into the brain anyway. So what we hope to maybe explore in the future is to use odors as a some kind of neurotherapy to keep the brain active and receiving signals when people are lying in hospitals in coma. So to use as some kind of like neurotraining with odors.
So you've mentioned a few things that are on the horizon for your research. Is there something else that you're really excited about that you're working on?
Yes. So we are doing work. We're trying to do two things, one which I think is very exciting. One is that we're trying to develop a new method to measuring signal from the olfactory bulb, which we talked about before, to use that as an early diagnostic tool of Parkinson. Because as I said, about 5 to 8 years before you get your Parkinson diagnosis, you will see that you lose your olfactory functions. However, even 5 years, 5 to 6 years before that, we see that the olfactory bulb is heavily affected. Unfortunately, right now, we have no means to measure a signal from the olfactory bulb in human, and that's why we're trying to develop a new method that we can actually assess the olfactory bulb and use it as the early screening for people who might be at risk for Parkinson. The other thing is that one of my core interests is also to understand why do we have a sense of smell. And my belief is that the sense of smell is there mainly as an approach avoidance mechanism. So it helps us either avoid danger or approach something that's very good.
How interesting. We'll have to talk to you again about your research. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Ewan Lundstrom is a cognitive psychologist at Manel Chemical Sense Center in Philadelphia and at Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden. He's also an adjunct professor, Department of Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. You can read more about the Manel Chemical Sense Center and the Karolinska Institute at the On the Record page at WIPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.